Chapter 4. During the next few days, Gibson was too busy with his own affairs to take much part in the somewhat limited social life of the Aries. His conscience had smitten him, as it always did when he rested for more than a week, and he was hard at work again. The typewriter had been disentangled from his belongings and now occupied the place of honor in the little cabin. Sheets of manuscript lay everywhere. Gibson was an untidy worker, and had to be prevented from escaping by elastic bands. There had been a lot of trouble with the flimsy carbon paper, which had a habit of getting into the airflow and gluing itself against the ventilator, but Gibson had now mastered the minor techniques of life under zero gravity. It was amazing how quickly one learned them, and how soon they became a part of everyday life. Gibson had found it very hard to get his impressions of space down on paper. One could not very well say, "Space is awfully big," and leave it at that. The takeoff from Earth had taxed his skill to the utmost. He had not actually lied, but anyone who read his dramatic description of the Earth falling away beneath the blast of the rocket would certainly never get the impression that the writer had then been in a state of blissful unconsciousness, swiftly followed by a state of far from blissful consciousness. As soon as he had produced a couple of articles which would keep Ruth happy for a while, she had meanwhile sent three further radiograms of increasing asperity, he went northwards to the signals office. Bradley received the sheets of manuscript with marked lack of enthusiasm. "I suppose this is going to happen every day from now on," he said glumly. "I hope so, but I'm afraid not. It depends on my inspiration." "There's a split infinitive right here on the top of page 2. "Excellent. Nothing like 'em. You've put centrifugal on page 3, where you mean centripetal. Since I get paid by the word, don't you think it's generous of me to use such long ones? There are two successive sentences on page 4, beginning with and. Look here, are you going to send the damn stuff, or do I have to do it myself?" Bradley grinned. "I'd like to see you try. Seriously, though, I should have warned you to use a black ribbon. Contrast isn't so good with blue, and though the facsimile sender will be able to handle it all right at this range, when we get farther away from Earth, it's important to have a nice, clean signal." As he spoke, Bradley was slipping the quarto sheets into the tray of the automatic transmitter. Gibson watched, fascinated, as they disappeared one by one into the maw of the machine, and emerged 5 seconds later into the wire collecting basket. It was strange to think that his words were now racing out through space in a continuous stream, getting a million kilometers farther away every 3 seconds. He was just collecting his manuscript sheets again when a buzzer sounded somewhere in the jungle of dials, switches, and meter panels that covered practically the entire wall of the little office. Bradley shot across to one of his receivers and proceeded to do incomprehensible things with great rapidity. A piercing whistle started to come from a loudspeaker. "The carrier's in range at last," said Bradley, "but it's a long way off, and I guess I'd say it will miss us by 100,000 kilometers.
"What can we do about that?"
"Very little. I've got our own beacon switched on, and if it picks up our signals, it will home on to us automatically and navigate itself to within a few kilometers of us."
"And if it doesn't pick us up?"
"Then it will just go shooting on out of the solar system. It's traveling fast enough to escape from the sun. So are we, for that matter."
"That's a cheerful thought. How long would it take us?"
"To do what?"
"To leave the system."
"A couple of years, perhaps. Better ask Mackay. I don't know all the answers. I'm not like one of the characters in your books."
"You may be one yet," said Gibson darkly, and withdrew.
The approach of the missile had added an unexpected and welcome element of excitement to life aboard the Ares. Once the first fine, careless rapture had worn off, space travel could become exceedingly monotonous. It would be different in future days, when the liner was crowded with life, but there were times when her present loneliness could be very depressing. The missile sweepstake had been organized by Dr. Scott, but the prizes were held firmly by Captain Norden. Some calculations of Mackay's indicated that the projectile would miss the Ares by 125,000 kilometers, with an uncertainty of plus or minus 30,000.
Most of the bets have been placed near the most probable value, but some pessimists, mistrusting Mackay completely, had gone out to 250,000 kilometers. The bets weren't in cash, but in far more useful commodities, such as cigarettes, candies, and other luxuries. Since the crew's personal weight allowance was strictly limited, these were far more valuable than pieces of paper with marks on them. Mackay had even thrown a half bottle of whiskey into the pool, and had thereby staked a claim to a volume of space about 20,000 kilometers across. He never drank the stuff himself, he explained, but was taking some to a compatriot on Mars, who couldn't get the genuine article and was unable to afford the passage back to Scotland. No one believed him, which, as the story was more or less true, was a little unfair.
"Jimmy!"
"Yes, Captain Norton. Have you finished checking the oxygen gauges?"
"Yes, sir. All okay."
"What about that automatic recording gear those physicists have put in the hold? Does it look as if it's still working?"
"Well, it's making the same sort of noises as it did when we started."
"Good. You've cleaned up that mess in the kitchen where Mr. Hilton let the milk boil over?"
"Yes, Captain."
"Then you've really finished everything?"
"I suppose so, but I was hoping—"
"That's fine. I've got a rather interesting job for you. Something quite out of the usual run of things. Mr. Gibson wants to start polishing up his astronautics. Of course, any of us could tell him all he wants to know, but you're the last one to come from college, and maybe you could put things across better. You've not forgotten the beginner's difficulties. We tend to take too much for granted. It won't take much of your time. Just go along when he asks and deal with his questions. I'm sure you can manage." Exit Jimmy, glumly.
"Come in," said Gibson, without bothering to look up from his typewriter. The door opened behind him as Jimmy Spencer came floating into the room.
"Here's the book, Mr. Gibson. I think it will give you everything you want. It's Richardson's Elements of Astronautics, special lightweight edition."
He laid the volume in front of Gibson, who turned over the thin sheets with an interest that rapidly evaporated as he saw how quickly the proportion of words per page diminished. He finally gave up halfway through the book after coming across a page where the only sentence was, "Substituting for the value of perihelion distance from equation 15.3, we obtain..." All else was mathematics.
"Are you quite sure this is the most elementary book in the ship?" he asked doubtfully, not wishing to disappoint Jimmy. He had been a little surprised when Spencer had been appointed as his unofficial tutor, but had been shrewd enough to guess the reason. Whenever there was a job that no one else wanted to do, it had a curious tendency to devolve upon Jimmy.
"Oh, yes, it really is elementary. It manages without vector notation and doesn't touch perturbation theory. You should see some of the books Mackay has in his room. Each equation takes a couple of pages of print."
"Well, thanks anyway. I'll give you a shout when I get stuck. It's about 20 years since I did any maths, though I used to be quite hot at it once. Let me know when you want the book back."
"There's no hurry, Mr. Gibson. I don't very often use it, now I've got onto the advanced stuff."
"Oh, before you go, maybe you can answer a point that's just cropped up. A lot of people are still worried about meteors, it seems, and I've been asked to give the latest information on the subject. Just how dangerous are they?"
Jimmy pondered for a moment.
"I could tell you roughly," he said, "but if I were you, I'd see Mr. Mackay. He's got tables given the exact figures."
"Right, I'll do that."
Gibson could quite easily have rung Mackay, but any excuse to leave his work was too good to be missed. He found the little astrogator playing tunes on the big electronic calculating machine.
"Meteors," said Mackay. "Ah, yes, a very interesting subject. I'm afraid, though, that a great deal of highly misleading information has been published about them. It wasn't so long ago that people believed a spaceship would be riddled as soon as it left atmosphere."
"Some of them still do," replied Gibson. "At least they think that large-scale passenger travel won't be safe."
Mackay gave a snort of disgust.
"Meteors are considerably less dangerous than lightning, and the biggest normal one is a lot smaller than a pea."
"But after all, one ship has been damaged by them."
"You mean the Star Queen? One serious accident in the last 5 years is quite a satisfactory record. No ship has ever actually been lost through meteors."
"What about the Pauls?"
"No one knows what happened to her. That's only the popular theory. It's not at all popular among the experts.
So I can tell the public to forget all about the matter?
Yes. Of course, there is the question of dust.
Dust?
Well, if by meteors you mean fairly large particles from a couple of millimeters upwards, you needn't worry. But dust is a nuisance, particularly on space stations. Every few years someone has to go over the skin to locate the punctures. They're usually far too small to be visible to the eye, but a bit of dust moving at 50 kilometers a second can get through a surprising thickness of metal.
This sounded faintly alarming to Gibson, and Mackay hastened to reassure him.
There really isn't the slightest need to worry, he repeated. There's always a certain hull leakage taking place. The air supply simply takes it in its stride.
However busy Gibson might be, or pretend to be, he always found time to wander restlessly around the echoing labyrinths of the ship, or to sit looking at the stars from the equatorial observation galley. He had formed a habit of going there during the daily concert. At 1500 hours precisely, the ship's public address system would burst into life, and for an hour the music of Earth would whisper or roar through the empty passageways of the Ares. Every day a different person would choose the programs, so one never knew what was coming, though after a while it was easy to guess the identity of the arranger. Norden played light classics and opera, Hilton practically nothing but Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. They were regarded as hopeless lowbrows by Mackay and Bradley, who indulged in astringent chamber music and atonal cacophonies of which no one else could make head or tail, or indeed particularly desired to. The ship's micro-library of books and music was so extensive that it would outlast a lifetime in space. It held, in fact, the equivalent of 250,000 books and some thousands of orchestral works, all recorded in electronic patterns, awaiting the orders that would bring them into life. Gibson was sitting in the observation gallery, trying to see how many of the Pleiades he could resolve with the naked eye, when a small projectile whispered past his ear and attached itself with a thwack to the glass of the port, where it hung vibrating like an arrow. At first sight, indeed, this seemed exactly what it was, and for a moment Gibson wondered if the Cherokee were on the warpath again. Then he saw that a large rubber sucker had replaced the head, while from the base, just behind the feathers, a long, thin thread trailed away into the distance. At the end of the thread was Dr. Robert Scott, M.D., hauling himself briskly along like an energetic spider. Gibson was still composing some suitable pungent remark when, as usual, the doctor got there first.
"Don't you think it's cute?" he said. "It's got a range of 20 meters, only weighs half a kilo, and I'm going to patent it as soon as I get back to Earth."
"Why?" said Gibson in tones of resignation.
"Good gracious, can't you see? Suppose you want to get from one place to another inside a space station where there's no rotational gravity. All you've got to do is to fire at any flat surface near your destination and reel in the cord. It gives you a perfect anchor until you release the sucker."
"And just what's wrong with the usual way of getting around?"
"When you've been in space as long as I have," said Scott smugly, "you'll know what's wrong. There are plenty of handholds for you to grab in a ship like this. But suppose you want to go over to a blank wall at the other side of a room, and you launch yourself through the air from wherever you're standing. What happens? Well, you've got to break your fall somehow, usually with your hands, unless you can twist round on the way. Incidentally, do you know the commonest complaint a spaceship MO has to deal with? It's sprained wrists, and that's why. Anyway, even when you get to your target, you'll bounce back unless you can grab hold of something. You might even get stranded in midair. I did that once in Space Station 3 in one of the big hangars. The nearest wall was 15 meters away, and I couldn't reach it."
"Couldn't you spit your way towards it?" said Gibson solemnly. "I thought that was the approved way out of the difficulty."
"You try it some day and see how far it gets you. Anyway, it's not hygienic. Do you know what I had to do? It was most embarrassing. I was only wearing shorts and vest, as usual, and I calculated that they had about 1/100 of my mass. If I could throw them away at 30 meters a second, I could reach the wall in about a minute."
"And did you?"
"Yes,
but the director was showing his wife round the station that afternoon. So now you know why I'm reduced to earning my living on an old hulk like this, working my way from port to port when I'm not running a shady surgery down by the docks."
"I think you've missed your vocation," said Gibson admiringly. "You should be in my line of business."
"I don't think you believe me," complained Scott bitterly.
"That's putting it mildly. Let's look at your toy."
Scott handed it over. It was a modified air pistol with a spring-loaded reel of nylon thread attached to the butt.
"It looks like—"
"If you say it looks like a ray gun, I'll certify you as infectious. Three people have made that crack already."
"Then it's a good job you interrupted me," said Gibson, handing the weapon back to the proud inventor.
"By the way, how's Owen getting on? Has he contacted that missile yet?"
"No, and it doesn't look as if he's going to. Max says it will pass about 145,000 kilometers away, certainly out of range. It's a damn shame. There's not another ship going to Mars for months, which is why they were so anxious to catch us."
"Owen's a queer bird, isn't he?" said Gibson with some inconsequence.
"Oh, he's not so bad when you get to know him. It's quite untrue what they say about him poisoning his wife. She drank herself to death of her own free will," replied Scott with relish.
Owen Bradley, Ph.D., M.I.E.E., M.I.R.E., was very annoyed with life. Like every man aboard the Ares, he took his job with a passionate seriousness, however much he might pretend to joke about it. For the last 12 hours he had scarcely left the communications cabin, hoping that the continuous carrier wave from the missile would break into the modulation that would tell him it was receiving his signals and would begin to steer itself towards the Ares. But it was completely indifferent, and he had no right to expect otherwise. The little auxiliary beacon which was intended to call such projectiles had a reliable range of only 20,000 kilometers. Though that was ample for all normal purposes, it was quite inadequate now. Bradley dialed the astrogation office on the ship's intercom, and Mackay answered almost at once.
"What's the latest, Mac?"
"It won't come much closer. I've just reduced the last bearing and smoothed out the errors. It's now 150,000 kilometers away, traveling on an almost parallel course. Nearest point would be 144,000 in about 3 hours. So I've lost the sweep, and I suppose we lose the missile."
"Looks like it, I'm afraid," grunted Bradley. "But we'll see. I'm going down to the workshop."
"Whatever for?"
"To make a one-man rocket and go after the blasted thing, of course. That wouldn't take more than a half an hour in one of Martin's stories. Come down and help me."
Mackay was nearer the ship's equator than Bradley. Consequently, he had reached the workshop at the South Pole first, and was waiting in mild perplexity when Bradley arrived, festooned with lengths of coaxial cable he had collected from stores. He outlined his plan briefly.
"I should have done this before, but it will make rather a mess, and I'm one of those people who always go on hoping till the last moment. The trouble with our beacon is that it radiates in all directions. It has to, of course, since we never know where carrier's coming from. I'm going to build a beam array and squirt all the power I've got after our runaway."
He produced a rough sketch of a simple Yagi aerial and explained it swiftly to Mackay.
"This dipole's the actual radiator. The others are directors and reflectors. Antique, but it's easy to make and it should do the job. Call Hilton if you want any help. How long will it take?"
Mackay, who for a man of his tastes and interests had a positively atavistic skill with his hands, glanced at the drawings and the little pile of materials Bradley had gathered.
"About an hour," he said, already at work. "Where are you going now?"
"I've got to go out on the hull and disconnect the plumbing from the beacon transmitter. Bring the array round to the airlock when you're ready, will you?"
Mackay knew little about radio, but he understood clearly enough what Bradley was trying to do. At the moment, the tiny beacon on the Ares was broadcasting its power over the entire sphere of space. Bradley was about to disconnect it from its present aerial system and aim its whole output accurately towards the fleeing projectile, thus increasing its range many-fold. It was about an hour later that Gibson met Mackay hurrying through the ship behind a flimsy structure of parallel wires spaced apart by plastic rods. He gaped at it in amazement as he followed Mackay to the lock, where Bradley was already waiting impatiently in his cumbersome spacesuit, the helmet open beside him.
"What's the nearest star to the missile?" Bradley asked.
Mackay thought rapidly.
"It's nowhere near the ecliptic now," he mused. "The last figures I got were, let's see, declination 15-something north, right ascension about 14 hours. I suppose that will be—I never can remember these things. Somewhere in Bootes. Oh, yes, it won't be far from Arcturus. Not more than 10 degrees away, I'd say at a guess. I'll work out the exact figures in a minute."
"That's good enough to start with. I'll swing the beam around anyway. Who's in the signals cabin now?"
"The skipper and Fred. I've rung them up, and they're listening to the monitor. I'll keep in touch with you through the hull transmitter."
Bradley snapped the helmet shut and disappeared through the airlock. Gibson watched him go with some envy. He had always wanted to wear a spacesuit, but though he had raised the matter on several occasions, Norden had told him it was strictly against the rules. Spacesuits were very complex mechanisms, and he might make a mistake in one. And then there would be hell to pay, and perhaps a funeral to be arranged under rather novel circumstances. Bradley wasted no time admiring the stars once he had launched himself through the outer door. He jetted slowly over the gleaming expanse of hull with his reaction units until he came to the section of plating he had already removed. Underneath it, a network of cables and wires lay nakedly exposed to the blinding sunlight, and one of the cables had already been cut. He made a quick temporary connection, shaking his head sadly at the horrible mismatch that would certainly reflect half the power right back to the transmitter. Then he found Arcturus and aimed the beam towards it. After waving it around hopefully for a while, he switched on his suit radio.
"Any luck?" he asked anxiously.
Mackay's despondent voice came through the loudspeaker.
"Nothing at all. I'll switch you through to communications."
Norden confirmed the news.
"The signal's still coming in, but it hasn't acknowledged us yet."
Bradley was taken aback. He had been quite sure that this would do the trick. At the very least, he must have increased the beacon's range by a factor of 10 in this one direction. He waved the beam around for a few more minutes, then gave it up. Already he could visualize the little missile with its strange but precious cargo slipping silently out of his grasp, out towards the unknown limits of the solar system and beyond. He called Mackay again.
"Listen, Mac," he said urgently, "I want you to check those coordinates again, and then come out here and have a shot yourself. I'm going in to doctor the transmitter."
When Mackay had relieved him, Bradley hurried back to his cabin. He found Gibson and the rest of the crew gathered glumly round the monitor receiver, from which the unbroken whistle from the distant and now receding missile was coming with a maddening indifference. There were very few traces of his normally languid, almost feline movements as Bradley pulled out circuit diagrams by the dozen and tore into the communications rack. It took him only a moment to run a pair of wires into the heart of the beacon transmitter. As he worked, he fired a series of questions at Hilton.
"You know something about these carrier missiles. How long must it receive our signal to give it time to home accurately onto us?"
"That depends, of course, on its relative speed and several other factors. In this case, since it's a low acceleration job, a good 10 minutes, I should say."
"And then it doesn't matter even if our beacon fails?"
"No. As soon as the carrier's vectored itself towards you, you can go off the air again. Of course, you'll have to send it another signal when it passes right by you, but that should be easy."
"How long will it take to get here, if I do catch it?"
"A couple of days, maybe less. What are you trying out now?"
"The power amplifiers of this transmitter run at 750 volts. I'm taking a 1,000-volt line from another supply, that's all. It will be a short life and a merry one, but we'll double or treble the output while the tubes last."
He switched on the intercom and called Mackay, who, now knowing the transmitter had been switched off for some time, was still carefully holding the array lined up on Arcturus like an armor-plated William Tell aiming a crossbow.
"Hello, Mac. You all set?"
"I'm practically ossified," said Mackay with dignity. "How much longer?"
"We're just starting now. Here goes."
Bradley threw the switch. Gibson, who had been expecting sparks to start flying, was disappointed. Everything seemed exactly as before. But Bradley, who knew better, looked at his meters and bit his lips savagely. It would take radio waves only half a second to bridge the gap to that tiny, far-off rocket with its wonderful automatic mechanisms that must remain forever lifeless unless this signal could reach them. The half-second passed, and the next. There had been time for the reply, but still that maddening heterodyne whistle came unbroken from the speaker. Then suddenly, it stopped. For an age, there was absolute silence. 150,000 kilometers away, the robot was investigating this new phenomenon. It took perhaps 5 seconds to make up its mind, and the carrier wave broke through again, but now modulated into an endless string of beep, beep, beeps. Bradley checked the enthusiasm in the cabin. "We're not out of the woods yet," he said. "Remember, it's got to hold our signal for 10 minutes before it can complete its course alterations." He looked anxiously at his meters and wondered how long it would be before the output tubes gave up the unequal battle. They lasted 7 minutes, but Bradley had spares ready and was on the air again in 20 seconds. The replacements were still operating when the missile carrier wave changed its modulation once more, and with a sigh of relief, Bradley shut down the maltreated beacon. "You can come indoors now, Mac," he called into the microphone. "We made it."
"Thank heavens for that. I've nearly got sunstroke, as well as calcification of the joints, doing this Cupid's bow act out here."
"When you've finished celebrating," complained Gibson, who had been an interested but baffled spectator, "perhaps you'll tell me in a few short, well-chosen phrases just how you managed to pull this particular rabbit out of the hat."
"By beaming our beacon signal and then overloading the transmitter, of course."
"Yes, I know that. What I don't understand is why you've switched it off again."
"The controlling gear in the missile has done its job," explained Bradley, with the air of a professor of philosophy talking to a mentally retarded child. "That first signal indicated that it had detected our wave. We knew then that it was automatically vectoring onto us. That took it several minutes, and when it had finished, it shut off its motors and sent us the second signal. It's still at almost the same distance, of course, but it's heading towards us now, and should be passing in a couple of days. I'll have the beacon running again then. That will bring it to within a kilometer or less."
There was a gentle cough at the back of the room.
"I hate to remind you, sir," began Jimmy.
Norden laughed.
"Okay, I'll pay up. Here are the keys, locker 26. What are you going to do with that bottle of whiskey?"
"I was thinking of selling it back to Dr. Mackay."
"Surely," said Scott, looking severely at Jimmy. "This moment demands a general celebration, at which a toast—" But Jimmy didn't stop to hear the rest. He had fled to collect his loot.